I was standing in my kitchen the other morning, waiting for the kettle to boil, when something hit me. I realized I'd been scrolling my phone for almost 10 straight minutes, completely disassociated. Well, a video I didn't choose autoplayed into another video I didn't choose. And by the time I came back around, I had no memory of what I'd even watched. Just this dull, lingering emotional static. It was like someone had used my brain as a storage unit and lost the keys. And in that moment, it occurred to me that my attention doesn't really feel like it belongs to me anymore. It feels rented out or like it's been hijacked. Basically, it's on loan to whoever can make my amygdala twitch the fastest. And of course, I blamed myself. Like, get it together, man. You really need to work on your discipline. As if it was a moral failing to be a human in a world that's designed specifically to override human defenses. And that's when it clicked for me that this feeling isn't really new. It's not digital or modern. This thing we're all drowning in has actually been cooking for over 100 years. And your phone is just the latest delivery vehicle and the most effective one, I might add. So the real story started long before any of us were born, in a place most people today wouldn't recognize, even if you spelled it out. All right, if you travel back to London in 1921 and you walk into a particular respectable looking building, there's a group of people inside studying the human mind like it's a machine that they were trying to reverse engineer. This place was called the Tavistock Institute. Now, officially, they were helping World War I soldiers recover from shell shock, what we now call PTSD. But unofficially, they discovered something that governments and corporations have been salivating over ever since. That trauma doesn't just hurt people, it makes them more compliant. Not really broken, malleable. So, grief, confusion, fear. Tavistock didn't just see these as symptoms. They saw them as levers, tools, basically. Ways to shape behavior without ever needing to get your hands dirty. And once you understood how to push an entire population into a psychological corner, you don't really need charismatic or influential leaders anymore. All you need is just the right pressure and the right emotion at the right time. So, By the end of World War II, Tavistock's influence had spilled into pretty much everything. Military strategy, public education, media, propaganda, advertising. The list goes on. And its fingerprints were everywhere that human behavior could be guided or optimized, which is really just a courteous way of saying they figured out how to make entire societies behave predictably. And right when that was happening, another character stepped onto the stage. So I've mentioned this guy before, Edward Bernays, Sigmund Freud's nephew, believe it or not. This was the man who looked at the unconscious mind and he thought, you know what this should be used for? Marketing and monetization. Bernays didn't want to understand people. He wanted to sell them. So, a few of the ideas that he managed to implement included convincing women that cigarettes were symbols of liberation. And he was the guy that branded bacon and eggs as the ultimate American breakfast. A so-called tradition that didn't actually exist until he invented it. He helped orchestrate the overthrow of Guatemala's democracy. Why? Because there was a fruit company that needed cheap, compliant labor. So he basically used psychology as a crowbar. Yeah. Maybe he should have booked a few sessions with his uncle Sigmund. So Bernays understood that if you attach emotion to something, people won't just buy it. They'll defend it. They'll even evangelize it and vote for it. So he turned democracy into a vibe of sorts, thus transforming propaganda into PR and desire into a weapon. And the USA said, fabulous, thank you. May we have some more? So then came the CIA, who looked at Bernays' work and Tavistock's research and decided to merge them into something significantly more unhinged. This became known as Operation Mockingbird. And their bright idea was that if you could control what the public saw and heard, you could indirectly control what they believed. So they put operatives inside newsrooms. They didn't politely influence journalists. They acted as journalists, anchors, editors, reporters, columnists. And by the 1970s, there were hundreds of people in American media who were on the CIA's payroll in one way or another. So imagine a world where the headlines weren't written by reporters, but by intelligence agents. Now stop imagining, because that was the world then. And not surprisingly, everyone more or less trusted it, because people would watch the news and think, yeah, this is the truth. I mean, it's on TV. And a professional-looking guy in a suit and tie is delivering the message in a calm and confident way. So it has to be true, right? But wait. There's more. Because the CIA wasn't quite done. Oh, no. So they said, what if we take all this psychological manipulation and crank it up to God mode? Enter MK Ultra. Extreme sleep deprivation, electroshock, LSD experiments so intense Timothy Leary would have tapped out, sensory isolation, identity erasure, and many other crimes against humanity. So there was a psychiatrist involved in this named Ewan Cameron, who blasted patients with looping audio messages while drugging and electroshocking them until some of them forgot how to speak, how to walk, recognize their families, even remember their own names. Isn't that nice? And by the way, these weren't really patients. They were unwilling subjects. Like test dummies, trial balloons for psychological warfare techniques. And when the documents eventually leaked decades later, everyone was, of course, shocked. As if we weren't already participating in a world built from those experiments. Because by then, the methods had already been absorbed into global intelligence playbooks. I mean, the tools work too well to abandon. And of course, the ethics were never even part of the equation. All right, so let's fast forward to today, where the lab coat has been replaced by the hoodie, and the clipboard has been replaced by the smartphone. And the experiments never really stopped. They just evolved and became more user-friendly, a little more hands-on. Your phone isn't a device. It's a behavioral modification machine with a data plan. Every moment you swipe, pause, react, flinch, or even hover, your nervous system is being dissected in real time. So you're not simply being shown content, you're being trained. And algorithms don't just learn what you like, they learn what destabilizes you and what heightens your cortisol and what makes you angry. Doom scroll. What keeps you in a state of mild, ongoing panic? Because fear holds attention, right? Confusion and rage and hopelessness also holds attention. And attention is the only currency that really matters in this day and age. So that makes us lab rats. Except the maze is inside our own skull, and we carry it everywhere like a decorative tumor. Have you ever really wondered why everything online feels like it's on fire all the time? Because outrage is the most cost-effective way to hijack a human being. It bypasses reason and nuance, and it bypasses reflection. So when you're pissed off, you're predictable. And when you're scrolling, you're obedient. You think that you're choosing what you feel, but in reality, your emotions are being farmed. Like corn, except we're the corn and someone else owns the field. And meanwhile, everyone walks around feeling defective. And now we have preteen depression. We've got millions of adults medicated just to get through the day. And people are mistaking engineered anxiety for personal failure. And that ache in your chest, that dread you feel when you wake up, that sense that reality feels somehow loose, that's not really a disorder. It's the exhaust trail of a century of psychological manipulation. So I think it's safe to say that we're not malfunctioning. We're responding exactly how the design intended. And you can see this everywhere. I mean, why is everyone chasing validation like it's oxygen? Why does no one feel satisfied after hitting every milestone that they were told would give their life meaning? Why do achievements feel like packing peanuts? Big in volume, but zero in substance. Well, because the system doesn't need you fulfilled. It just needs you preoccupied and exhausted. And it needs you emotionally overclocked and spiritually underfed. Dead people can't participate in society, but numb people, well, they're perfect. They're hyper-productive, hyper-compliant, they're hyper-manageable, and so on. The system would prefer to turn you into a user profile with predictable emotional reactions rather than kill you. For now, anyway. Because a mildly distressed, endlessly scrolling consumer with a pulse is slightly more useful than a dead one. For now, anyway. But here's the weird part. If you're still here listening to this, it probably means something inside of you never bought the script. I don't mean the surface level you, the one scrolling and comparing and constantly worrying. I mean the deeper part, the person you were before you learned to perform. The part that occasionally whispers something about all of this feels fundamentally wrong. And it's not paranoia. It's memory. It's an older intelligence. It's an instinct that predates all of this psychological scaffolding. So, more accurately, you're not discovering something new. You're remembering something ancient. Which is to say, you're not broken. You're just waking up. And waking up is disorienting. This isn't about finding yourself. That phrase, it's way too soft for the moment that we're in. And besides, I don't believe in the concept of the self that we're raised on, but that's a whole other matter. This is more about stopping. Stopping the autopilot, the mimicry, the performance review that the world runs on your identity. And the moment you stop feeding the machine, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, it begins to starve. The second you stop reacting, you stop being a lab rat, and you stop being exploited data. And that's when you meet the real you. The one that existed before the algorithm learned your name. It's the you that, well, it's the you with a life that doesn't feel scripted and a mind that doesn't feel like it's been purchased. And a sense of self that isn't packaged for the public to consume. That life is still there. It's been waiting underneath all the noise. And you can hear it in the silence between notifications if you listen carefully. You can feel it when you're bored. And you can sense it when something in your body is telling you, this isn't right. This is not how humans are supposed to live. And it's true. It's been true the whole time. Everything around us is destabilizing now. And not just politically or culturally or economically, psychologically, the spell is thinning. People are noticing the script, and they're becoming aware of all the programming and the artificiality. The manipulation, the fatigue. And once you see the strings, you can't pretend the puppet is alive anymore. The system is cracking. You can see daylight through it at this point. And beneath all the conditioning, beneath all the branding and algorithms and outrage and all the chaos, your real life is still waiting. Not the one you were handed, or the one with the carrot on the stick that you were told to chase. The one where you were supposed, the one you were supposed to have before the experiment started. So the question now is this: who were you, or who are you, when the script ends? Because that's the real you, the one that they tried to overwrite, the one that never really went away. And now that you're remembering, you're not going back. At least I hope not. All right. On that note, that's all I've got today. As always, thanks for listening.